We're continuing our sermon series, Slings and Stones. We're taking a closer look, as Robin indicated, that we're taking a closer look at David and Goliath and Saul and examining it more closely. And today we're going to talk about fear. Fear must fall. Fear. If you have never felt it at some point in your life, check your pulse. Whether it's the anticipatory nervousness of being on a roller coaster ascending that first hill, the anxiousness and sweaty palms of asking your crush out on a date, or the abject terror of going in for an MRI only to realize that you're claustrophobic, fear happens. Very famous, very successful people have faced fear just like everyone else. And they have analyzed it and stepped back from it, taken a look at it, picked it apart, and figured it out to the best of their abilities to offer some words of encouragement. You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You are able to say to yourself, I have lived through this horror. I can take the next thing that comes along. Eleanor Roosevelt. We can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light. Plato. My story is a freedom song of struggle. It is about finding one's purpose, how to overcome fear, and to stand up for causes bigger than oneself. Coretta Scott King. The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, and the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. That's H.P. Lovecraft, who is a horror novelist. So, are there any Harry Potter fans out there? So, you might have children or grandchildren who are into the books and the movies. I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. My favorite book in the series is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. It was actually the first one in the series that I read, and then I had to go back and read the first two to get caught up. What's not to love about a coming-of-age story? Conquering fears that have a unique look in the author's world, but at the same time are very relatable in our world. Overcoming bullies, navigating school, trying to make friends, figuring out your personal identity and why you're set apart, acquiring a pet owl, or maybe not. In the movie version, Professor Remus Lupin, who's played by David Thewlis, is trying to teach the students how to deal with a creature called a boggart. This particular one lives in a wardrobe, freestanding wardrobe. But no one knows what a boggart actually looks like because it takes on the shape of the thing that you fear the most. And to defeat it, you have to think of something funny and say, ridiculous! Student Neville Longbottom is terrified of Professor Severus Snape, who intimidates almost all the students at Hogwarts, and he was a student there himself at the same time as Professor Lupin and Harry Potter's parents. So naturally, Neville's boggart looks like Professor Snape, portrayed by the late Alan Rickman. But Professor Lupin has an amusing way to deal with it.
Frightens you most of all?
Professor Snape.
Frightens all. And I believe you live with your grandmother.
Yes, but I don't want that boggart to turn into her either.
No. It won't. I want you to picture her clothes, only her clothes, very clearly in your mind.
She carries a red handbag.
You don't need to hear.
As long as you see it, we'll see it. Now, when I open that wardrobe, here's what I want you to do.
Imagine Professor Snape in your clothes.
Can you do that? Yes. Wand at the ready. One, two, three. Think, never think.
Ridiculous!
Wonderful, Devil, wonderful, incredible. Okay, to the back, Devil. Everyone form a line.
Throughout the series, we learn that everyone has a fear. Ron Weasley has a well-documented fear of spiders. Parvati Patil fears snakes. Professor Lupin, who's a werewolf, is afraid of moonlight. Molly Weasley is afraid of her children and Harry dying. And Harry himself is afraid of the dementors of Azkaban, the ghostly guards of Azkaban prison who feed on your emotions. Author J.K. Rowling once said in an interview that the dementors represent the depression that she fought for years. One could say she fought her fear by placing it in a book and making it into something that could be defeated. And by the way, in the book, the treatment for a dementor attack is chocolate. Each of the students in Professor Lupin's class needs to overcome his or her fear of the thing that they see standing before them in order to defeat the boggart itself. They have to face and overcome their fear before they can overcome their giant. Your fear might be something visible or tangible, something known with a name. Your fear may be of the dark, of snakes, or fire. You may be afraid of flying or deep water. And often the best way for us to manage fears like that is to just avoid the thing that frightens us. Your fear may be something that has a name, but it's harder to conquer. You may fear failure because you don't want to be ridiculed. You may fear success because people, you know, the nebulous and nonspecific people, may expect you to keep succeeding, and then what happens? Because eventually you think you'll fail. You may fear being alone. You may fear being around too many people. These are fears that impact your quality of life. They get in the way of living the one miraculous life that God has given you. You fear failure so that you don't reach out for the dreams that you have. You fear success so you sabotage your own efforts at work or at school. You fear being alone so you put yourself into harmful relationships or try to fill that void with other things like drugs or food or shopping. You fear being around people, so you simply don't go out. And we have goals, too. We have things that we want to do, places we want to go and see, challenges that we want to meet. Our goals are our giants. But before we can conquer our giants, we have to defeat fear. Until we can laugh at fear, until we can say, "You don't own me," and "You don't frighten me," we will struggle against the giant. In the scripture read today, Goliath the Philistine continues to taunt the Israelite army. The two armies are on high ground on either side of the valley of Elah. Now, from a political standpoint, it's a huge waste of human life and military resources to have both armies clashing repeatedly. So the common practice was for top warriors from each side to meet in the middle and fight on behalf of both armies. Whoever won the fight, the whole army would then be declared victorious. For 40 days, Goliath comes out every morning and every evening to taunt the Israelites, and his challenges go unanswered. But Goliath doesn't realize who he's taunting. the army of God's chosen people. He's picking a fight with God's children. And God might have something to say about that. It's like the Israelite army has forgotten whose they are. They're not Saul's. They're God's. They are the people of God, and yet they stand there and take the ridicule as if they're believing all the trash talking coming from Goliath. They believe what they see in here, and here, a large man in armor with an attitude and a javelin. They seem to have lost faith in what they cannot see, and that is God. And then there's David. Young David has played the lyre for Saul and found favor with him. He's been appointed Saul's armor bearer, but Saul's not doing a lot of fighting, so it's more of a job title. David has already been anointed by Samuel, and yet David's just kind of there. He tends the sheep for his father Jesse, runs up to the front to give some food to his brothers, and then he goes back and tends the sheep. So is David ignored because he's young? Because he's not part of the fighting army? Even though he's been anointed, do they think he's too young to live into it? Just like the Israelites are fearful of Goliath and believe their eyes and ears over their hearts and their faith, so can it be with us. We hear people telling us all the reasons our plans will not work, or the timing isn't right, or it's not practical. We fear they might be right. We may even tell ourselves the same things. We believe we don't deserve to have dreams and goals. We start to believe the naysayers and the voices in our heads and the illusions that our eyes tell us. That mountain is too big for you to climb. Maybe, by ourselves. But with God, all things are possible. It was after Saul and David's time, but Paul let the Romans know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son in order that he might be the firstborn within a large family. All things work together for good for those who love God. Our version of things working together for good might not look like God's version, but that doesn't mean that God doesn't love us and that God isn't on our side. So back to the Valley of Elah and David. David received anointing from God through Samuel as the next king. He remains a shepherd, taking care of his father's sheep, and the dutiful son helping tend to his older brothers. He's been going back and forth, serving others, and hasn't really been subjected to the bullying and intimidation of Goliath. David's focused on truth and reality. He has no reason to believe that he isn't a beloved child of God. He has no reason to believe that the Philistines won't eventually be defeated. The answer to the Goliath problem is in plain sight. It's David. Don't believe that you are anything less than a beloved child of God. God is with us. He gives us wisdom and discernment to identify our fears. He equips us with gifts and graces to hurdle that fear barrier and conquer our giants. Every giant is going to put forth the scariest possible facade to keep us from moving forward. And the more we fade and the more we retreat, the longer that giant is going to keep showing up to taunt us and to bully us and prevent us from living the life that we were meant to have. Fear is the first weapon of your giant, whether it's negativity, intimidation, verbal or emotional abuse, naysaying, discouragement, ridicule. Anything that creates fear is what the giant will use. You may not even realize what your real fear is. Just like the boggart in the cupboard in the movie, you sometimes can't see your fear in its true form. But it's going to keep showing up until two things happen. You name it, and you claim it. Name it. Name the fear. Admit to whatever fear you're feeling. It might take some digging, might take some scary self-analysis, but dig into it. What are you really afraid of? It's like being sick and not knowing why, and then you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "We think it's this." And once you can put a name on it, it's like, all right, now what do we do? How do we deal with this? It gives us power. Name your fear, that elusive little force field that's being created by your giant, because once you name it, you rob fear of its power. And then claim it. Claim your title as a child of God. There is all kinds of power in that claim and in that relationship. You're equipped with all you need to face fear and face your giant. God is with you, giving you armor. God is with you anytime through the power of prayer. And wherever you are at that moment, God is with you. What is your fear? What is the boggart in your wardrobe? What does your giant look like? Think about it. What would you really like to overcome? What's scary about your giant? It's okay to admit the fear. Name it. Then talk to the one who can help you stand firm. Listen to God. You are equipped. You are God's child. Claim that. Fear will fall.